This is BBC Radio 5 Live. News, sport and entertainment.
Fridays, 2 till 4. Simon Mayo and Mark Hermode's Film Review. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. This is 5 Live.
Does that count as a jingle?
Yeah, but also, is it me or was there an edit in that Mark Hermode? It sounds like somebody said Mark Hermode and they went, so no, it's Kermode. I mean, I may be just imagining
we've
that.
We've been doing this for nearly 9 years. We've never had a jingle before.
I know. So we've now got one that sounds like it's got an edit in the middle of it.
And what we'd like, what we'd really like, is to have Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode with their special guest today, Mr. John Hurt. Sort of sung like that.
I could sing it.
It sounds almost like playing songs, doesn't it?
Hello, John, how are you?
I'm very well.
I'm very, very good to have you on the programme. But hang on, so, Mark, were you building up to...
No. Since John has leapt in quite rightly to stop me singing, I'm not going to stop.
I would never have leapt in if I thought he was going to stop you singing.
No, I think... Well, the thing is, because you have the voice. I was just thinking the other day, because I was listening... No, because I was... I'm quite a fan of Mandalay and Dogville for strange reasons, and of course, so much of what's good about those films is the sort of the sonorous tone of the very ironic and dry voiceover that you deliver in it. And of course, you have the perfect radio voice, so therefore, I should just back away from the microphone and let you just talk. Oh, all right, do that.
Just being difficult and arty. There's a friend of mine, a writer by the name of Malcolm Doney, who once reviewed some of your work, John, and he said... Do you remember, by the way, before we get there, I know I was just a little going off at a tangent like Ronnie Corbett, do you remember having a Gaelic coffee? Do you remember what a Gaelic coffee was?
Coffee, very much remember. Yeah.
Yes. So, like, whiskey...
Yeah. Has to be made out of instant coffee.
Is that right? So it's whiskey with coffee, yeah?
It's Irish whiskey with coffee, yeah.
And Malcolm wrote... If a Gaelic coffee could talk, it would sound like John Hurt.
Oh, it's Irish whiskey with coffee with cream on top of it.
That's right.
So that its cream is even more sort of... And why it has to be instant coffee is that it doesn't make that perfect cream. It breaks up if it's real coffee.
This is good. This is good stuff. Anyway, you are the oral equivalent of a Gaelic coffee, John.
Well, I'm very flattered.
44-inch Chest is a new movie with some... cast list here. We have Ray Winston, Tom Wilkinson, Ian McShane, Stephen Delane, Joanne Whalley and John Hurt playing Old Man Peanut.
Yeah, that's what he's called.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's the accent. I trust you aren't going to use any of the vernacular.
I don't think I'm allowed to use it. Exactly right. I'd be bleepity bleep bleep bleep, wouldn't I?
It would. So explain Old Man Peanut and just explain the story that we
should say as well that we do have a clip of Old Man Peanut which involves none of the vernacular. I believe
I don't think there is passed through
the blender.
In that case, it can't be much to do with Old Man.
No, there is. It's still there. I think they've gone through and removed some of the more Anglo-Saxon. Well, you can hear it.
It'd be very difficult. I mean, there is a huge amount of language. There's no point in saying there isn't. But I think you have to get above that. You have to realise that it is actually a language. Rather than language, and that it is in itself a means of communication.
Okay, so explain who Old Man
Peanut
is. Anyway,
Old Man Peanut is he's an old-fashioned. These are all guys that have been around the parish quite a bit of time. You know, none of them are unaware of what falls off a lorry. You know, or that things do fall off lorries.
They're all crooks.
Well, there's nothing to say they are, but I think that they're streetwise.
They're crooks.
Shall we say they're streetwise? We don't look. I'm not much of a politician anyway, but I can't be drawn into saying what they are because there's nothing to say what they are.
I don't think anyone will walk out of the film thinking that they're on the straight and narrow.
No, they're not on the straight and narrow, that's for certain. It's a bit wobbly. That's also for certain. But, I mean, whether they're actively crooks in the sort of Scorsese sense of the word, I'm not sure.
Well, they are prepared to beat the living daylights out of a Frenchman.
Oh, yeah, they are. They're about to beat, yes. They're more hungry for it, really,
yes.
In Old Man Peanut's case. But it's to do with infidelity and what happens to the person who is unfaithful, who gets taken.
We should just explain for those who
haven't... It's difficult to... Yeah.
No, well, okay,
you're probably better at it than me.
Probably not, John, but thank you for having that faith in me. The setup of it is that Ray Winston's character is in a state of some disarray. It transpires that the reason he's in this state of some disarray is that his wife, to whom he appears to be devoted, has walked off with another man. We meet him in a room in which there is almost nothing in the room other than a large piece of furniture and a sofa in which he's sitting. He is then joined by various associates, all of whom seem to at least exist in some form of seedy underworld. world. I mean, the movie itself is largely set in one room, but there is a sense that the world that they inhabit is somewhat murky. And it transpires over the course of their conversations that he has really come to the end of his tether, and as a result of having come to the end of his tether, has probably gone out and is on the brink of doing something about it. And I don't want to say much more than that, because some of the joy of it is discovering exactly what it is that they suggest. But your character, Old Man Peanut, his suggestion is, come on, pull yourself together, get over it. You've been wronged, now right the wrong.
Absolutely. Well, you did that brilliantly.
Thank you
very
much.
Far better than I could, because I'm too involved with it.
Let's take our careers in our hands and play you a clip from 44-inch Chest, featuring John Hurt as Old Man Peanut.
How is he? All right?
Yeah, he's all right, ain't you, Connie?
Yeah. You get it together, you hear me? We can't have this. Tonight the kid gloves are off. Show some backbone. You're a man.
He'll get there.
And the bloodied slave rose to his feet, thrust his hand into his defiant chest, tore out his own heart, threw it at the aggressor, saying, free from bondage.
Yeah, well, whatever. This thing's got to be finished tonight because I'm busy tomorrow.
You break every other engagement. This takes top priority above everything. Till this is done and dusted, put to bed, lay to rest, nobody does nothing but this. This is where we are. Here, now, this. You hear me, Colin?
I just can't believe it. I can't.
Anybody want any crisps?
That's Tom Wilkinson coming in right at the end there.
We should say, though, for people who are listening rather than watching, so during that, John was rolling his eyes and going, because I know, because obviously...
90 I mean, edits the defence rests.
No, the, yes,
I
well...
I mean, it simply doesn't work. With, I mean, it's been put into a language.
I should say that we didn't do that. That is the clip as supplied by the film company.
I'm quite sure. Yes.
But that is the broadcastable version. But you're quite right that if you take the profanity out of it, it becomes a different thing because so much of it is to do with the language and the nuances in the language,
you'd think that it would be the other way around, but it isn't. It's the nuance is all in the language and how it's said, where it's approached, when it comes in. It's all to do with the rhythm. It's to do with so many things in terms of what we call communication.
But it was, I guess, the issue is you either play that
or nothing,
or it doesn't get played at all.
Yes, I think that's the case.
I think that's the issue. Why is Old Man Peanut quite so... I mean, he appears the angriest of all of the characters.
He's the last of a breed. He's a great believer in eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, vengeance, and so on. It interests me because when I first got it, which I thought was a superb piece of writing, I might say, but it's... all his references throughout the film are biblical. And it's kind of interesting to me because I think that all those East End boys in their long shorts, you know, and their boots, were sent off to Sunday school to learn a bit about religion. And this is what sticks, and it's all in those books. I don't know if you... I mean, I can remember Sunday school, but then my father was a clergyman, so I would, in the 1940s.
And your brother's a monk?
Yes, but he's a Catholic, so he's a convert.
Same Bible.
It's the same Bible, different God, it seems.
He might take issue with that.
Well, the Church of England, my father would have considered the Catholic God to be, or at least the Catholic Church, to be Antichrist. Right. So it's not far off, is it?
So were you... I know we've gone off at a
tangent.
Listen,
I was born a Methodist. I'm staying out of this as far as I'm concerned.
Yes. you're Methodist, are you?
Well, I was brought up as a Methodist. My family's Manx. So
cracker
that's
of a conversation.
Exactly,
after
yes.
Over, yeah. Anyway, yes, so I think a lot of it came, all that early imagery, and stayed with him all his life, you know? And it's he's not the brightest man in the world. He's not the nicest either. But at the same time, I think he's like a lot of what would be called the dregs of society, often victims rather than anything else.
But he went to Sunday school, he just went for the Old Testament bits, basically.
Those are the things that tweaked his imagination. Yeah. He tells a big story in the film, and it's clear how it hit him, you know, what it meant to him. But it's still very confused as to why he should suddenly relate it. But it's
a very, most of the conversation between you and Ray Winston and Tom Wilkinson, Ian McShane, Stephen DeLay, it's very macho, isn't it? It's a very macho conversation, and outdated.
It's outdated. It's definitely in the 40s, 50s, really. It's that sort of world.
And
yeah, it's the end of a period. I think Colin actually is. You could find him around. Colin being Ray Winston's part, but his friends and the people that surround him, supposedly his mentors or whatever, are dropping off the face of the earth, I think.
And in between all this conversation and the violence and the threat of violence, Ray Winston is a man who's distraught because he's lost his wife, and he has some very moving passages in which he's saying to the adulterous Frenchman, you know, just explaining what married life is really like.
And rather brilliantly. Yes. Wonderful writing.
But can we talk a little bit about the writers? Because, of course, it's written by the same pair of writers who wrote Gangster No. 1 and wrote Sexy Beast. And as I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, the script was written around the same time that those two pieces were written, but has been around for a while, and they are no longer working. I mean, did you work with them? Were they involved in the production? Because the writing is... They have a very, very clear voice, those two.
They did.
Lewis Mellis and David Sinto.
David Sinto, yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I think together they're fantastic. I don't know what they're like separate, because I have nothing to go by.
But have you worked with them or just with their script?
Oh, no. Whenever I've met Louis, it's been with Louis. And when I've met David, it's been with David.
Oh, right, okay.
But they're not together in that sense. You know, they're just... I don't know what their problems are. It's not my business, really.
No, sure.
But I agree that it's kind of sad, because they do have a fabulous voice and they're working together. And that's how they work. I mean, the marvelous thing, they don't work in any intellectual way whatsoever. They bounce off each other. They suggest something, says something, that goes to something else, and it's all instinctive, bouncing off each other and so on. And so
they also, whatever it is that they do or did together, it works in a very particular way, but they've described themselves as being outside, feeling like outsiders in the film industry, and they seem to work in a very, their scripts are very distinctive. It's hard to think of quite such distinctive voices elsewhere in British cinema. You can hear their dialogue, and you know that that's what it is.
I completely agree with you. I do. I think it's, yes.
It's also interesting that the film itself, on the poster, it says, from the writers of Sexy Beast. I can't remember the last time I saw a poster that said, from the writers of...
No, absolutely. It is. It's right at the centre of culturally, of our society. Yeah, absolutely.
85058 on the text. John in Edinburgh says, Dear Simon, can you wish John Hurt a happy birthday for next week? I share the same birthday, says John. And my birthday wish would be for John to sit again by the fire for more Storyteller. The Soldier That Cheated Death was my favourite.
That was the Jim Henson series called The Storyteller, of which there were nine. Yeah.
The most controversial thing that we've addressed is not 44-inch chest, nothing to do with language. It's all about Irish coffee.
That's coming in.
Yes. Dan says, far be it from me to argue with the marvellous John Hurt, but I've been making perfect Irish coffee with proper coffee for years, as has my old Irish mother. The trick is to make a slight suspension of the liquid by adding two brown sugars, making sure it's thoroughly dissolved and slightly thickening the cream. Then, with the coffee still rotating in the glass from a good stirring, gently pour the cream over the back of a large spoon so it gently floats. Far superior to an instant coffee version and not at all hard. Sorry to be pedantic, says Dan.
Delighted to hear that, Dan. I'm absolutely thrilled. I'm going entirely on the evidence that I have was given to me by a girlfriend in Ireland. So she's. I'll be able to. When I see her again, I'll tell her she's quite wrong.
Yes, okay. You broke up for a number of reasons, but that was one of them.
That was it.
Her Irish coffee was entirely
terrible,
inappropriate. Because we've got a two-hour show as opposed to sort of an hour and a bit of movie conversation. There were big BBC meetings, and they decided that we needed to have something like a format.
Oh, really? Okay, fine.
Did you go to that meeting?
I didn't. No, I wasn't invited.
So here's our new exciting bit of format. We've got three questions that we're going to ask all our movie guests on a Friday afternoon.
Well, that's what constitutes a format, is it? Three questions.
It's three questions.
In other words, it runs through from one show to another show.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for explaining that, John, because I was dragging behind.
It's constant.
Okay, fine.
Yes. So we'll be doing this every Friday, Mark.
Every Friday you're going to ask the same dreary question to somebody else, do you think?
Well, of course, you were...
Look at him, don't look at me.
Of course, John, you were famous for saying... I think in The Guardian. You're right, sir. Excellent.
I'm getting over a cough.
you were quoted as saying there are basically six questions a journalist asks, and all of them are versions of how do you act? These are going to be different questions, completely different
well,
questions.
Well, they are. Okay. I mean, it was a somewhat facetious reply, but I mean, in a sense, it acting so fascinates journalists and people, in fact. They can't, it seems that it should be so simple. All you're doing is talking, isn't it? I mean, you're doing just, and pretending to be somebody else. That can't be difficult. There can't be a livelihood in that, surely.
Anyway, we're distracted from our format. Here come the format questions. You'll notice that hours and hours of work have gone into this, which we're prepared to sell around the world.
You've got a tricky one.
OK, question number one.
How do you act?
No, sorry, no. No, that's question six. What's the first film you ever went to see?
No, that I can answer very... I'm almost certain that the first film I went to see was Treasure Island, which was somewhere around about 1947, something like that, I think, probably, with Robert Newton playing Jim, you know?
Yeah.
And it was in Technicolor.
Do you remember where it was that you saw it?
I was living in Derbyshire at the time, so I think probably it was somewhere around about Woodville, Swaddling Coat.
But you don't have a specific memory of you can't remember the
actual cinema. No, I don't. I have a funny feeling it might have been the Empire Swaddling Coat. And the Empire Swaddling Coat used to have an advert in the Burton Evening Mail, which said, "Come to the Empire on the sunny side of Swad." Which I've always kind of liked, because it seemed to be not perhaps the best day or the best reason for going to a cinema anyway. But anyway, yeah.
Our second question, which we like quite a lot, is a film that made you cry, or a scene in a film that you could describe to us which upset you.
And this has to be genuine crying, isn't it? I mean, actually made you cry.
Well, how you define? Well, you can well up. I mean.
Well, no, I think it has to be cry.
What, sob? No, you can't sob. No, one sobs in films.
Tears. You cry in films.
Well, can I mention one of mine? Is that allowed? Or is that just considered
John Hurt,
unbelievably
John, you're John Hurt, and you're the first person we've done this with. We're making the rules as we go along.
But it's just that it could be really naff, couldn't it? Oh, well, made one. Yeah. But I did make one that genuinely did that, and I know it has done to many, many other people, and that's The Elephant Man. And it did it when I read the script. I found it difficult to finish reading the script for some reason. It was just so moving. So that's the first one that comes to mind. I have been made to cry many times, and infuriatingly, not necessarily at good movies either. You can be watching Coronation Street and it makes you cry.
Or me. Would you cry more if you're on your own, John, or would you cry, you know, if you're with other people?
I think it depends. A lot of that depends on the mood you're in. If you're prepared to be mellow enough to sort of float into tears and out, but that's not... I don't know whether that's really what you mean. Why I said Elephant Man is because I defy anyone not to cry.
It's incredible with Elephant Man, because I remember going to see Elephant Man... Because I'd seen Eraserhead and thinking, you know, David Lynch was dark and all that stuff. And I went to see Elephant Man with somebody I was going out with at the time, thinking I was going, you know, it's a David Lynch film, it's going to be darker. And literally in the first sort of 10 minutes, and then spending the whole of the film attempting to pretend that I wasn't crying. Because you do. And it is just sob after sob. I mean,
Americans are very interesting. There's some big American men, they like to come up to you and say, you know, John, I just love that movie. It nearly made me cry.
Nearly.
Nearly, yes. They never cry, of course. Boys don't cry.
David Lynch has described you as the greatest actor he's ever worked with.
Well, that's enough to give him. Well, that's very kind of him.
It is, and an astute comment.
No, I think, actually, what he particularly liked was my left hand.
Right.
Because I don't have a hairy arm, and I have a quite expressive left hand, which he needed, which he used rather a lot.
And our final... question of substance. Is there a film that you liked which, frankly, everyone else took a pass on?
Now, that's the tricky... That's when I said a tricky question. That is a difficult one. Because it's difficult to think of a film that nobody liked.
Well, in general, seems to be passing
a film that
by.
Didn't get picked up quite as well as it should. I certainly remember seeing Stephen Frears' first film, Gumshoe. I thought it was a terrific film. And I thought it was really really, really nice film indeed. And it never really got picked up. And Stephen never didn't do anything more in the cinema until he did The Hit, in fact, which I did with him.
When you're working on a film, John, do you get an instinctive sense as to whether it's going to be a big successful film? Or is there just something you think, you know what, we're really onto something here, or does it still baffle you?
I think the latter is nearer. I think you think, well, we're onto something, we know we're doing something good, but you I don't think you can ever be completely sure that it's going to be commercially as successful or have an impact, say, that sometimes they do. Sometimes you think it is going to have an impact and it doesn't.
But the classic case of that must have been Alien. I mean, I made a documentary about Alien, which you're in briefly, and there's the whole...
Famous.
Everyone talks about... No, but everyone talks about being on the set of Alien and how extraordinary the designs were and everything. But, of course, when you're on a set, it looks like a set. And that... Because we now all think of Alien as being such a precise and pristine creation, and Giger's creations are so extraordinary, and, you know, Ridley Scott's direction is so... But being on set of it and doing the chest burster scene, which has now become, you know, one of the most famous moments... At the time, surely it seemed goofy. I mean, Ridley Scott himself tells a story about the first time Giger showed him the chest burster. He looked like a stuffed chicken or something, like some kind of hand puppet, and he wasn't sure it was going to work.
Well, we weren't sure, because it was long pre-CGI, and you've got one prop man underneath the table, but in the cut to the other side of the table, when I was in my throes of agony, I got onto the table... And in that cut, my body was put through a hole in the table. So you've got my chest. You see, imagine me just sort of like an Allen key, you know?
Yeah.
And the rest of my body was built on the table. And the one prop man was sort of pushing up with the alien on the end of a stick, like a ice lolly, you know? Is it coming through yet, Alf? No, I can't see it yet. No, Ed, no, it's not coming through yet. Give it another shove. No.
That's old man Peanut again.
Sort of thing.
But the story that's told about that, and incident, I didn't mean in the film briefly, I meant in the documentary briefly, obviously famously in Alien. The story that's told by Ridley Scott is that that you were there being set up for, you know, with the rig done, and everybody else was kept off the set, and that when they were ready to go... They said, OK, fine, and they brought everyone else on. Everyone else had a vague idea what was going to happen, but they did, particularly Veronica Cartwright, for example, did not know that they were going to do the chest burster as it did, and the famous apocryphal story is the reaction of the actors around as the thing comes out of your chest is genuine.
Well, it is genuine, but I mean, Veronica wasn't taking notice at school, in school, that's okay. All. She didn't know what was going on, because...
Yeah, it'd be hard not to see the blood with the
one, it was in the script, and it was actually going to happen, but, but what they didn't know is how it was going to happen. And it was little explosive caps put all around the, you know, when it went, it took, psh, it went. And they should have guessed, because they really was using at least five cameras, using two shots and close-ups, and it's all in one shot. So it's fairly unusual in a movie to do all that.
While we're on the subject, an email from Nick Cunningham in Peterborough, Ontario, as in Ontario, Canada, obviously. Simon, a moment ago, John coughed. And you asked him if he was okay. I was wondering if anyone else in the world listening to that immediately thought of that scene from Alien. Which is fantastic, because it didn't, but of course it should have done. Hang on, John's going to go again. That's what occurred to Nick Cunningham in
Peterborough.
Very
good. Yeah,
We've got a whole bunch of emails and texts. I think you can stay for about another 5 minutes, John. Is that right?
Oh, look, I'll do what I'm told.
Excellent. Right, in that case, you stay for the rest of the programme. That's an hour and a half of John Hurt.
John Hurt is with us for another few minutes. 44-inch Chest is his latest film. And an interesting text from Gareth and Kendall, which I read out, John, because I think I'm right in saying one of his favourite performances of yours is one of yours as well. Gareth says, could you tell John that his performance as the ill-fated Stephen Ward in the film Scandal always moves me to tears? We're talking about films that move you. But I think you're very proud of that film.
I did like that film, yes. I thought it was it's one of the first film I made with Michael Caton-Jones, and I've enjoyed all three films I made with him. And they were completely different. And it's kind of interesting. You don't often get that feeling with a director.
There was a week, Mark, a couple of years back, where we reviewed two films by Michael Caton-Jones on the same day, and they were both, exactly as John says, completely different.
One of them was it called? Was it Shooting Dogs?
Shooting Dogs. So,
and the other one was Basic Instinct 2.
That's right.
Yeah, well, he did that directly afterwards. Well, he did he's very honest about it.
I like Basic Instinct 2.
I thought
Basic Instinct 2 had a much funnier script than people gave it credit for. That was a script. I mean, actually, they are proper screenwriters, but that seemed to me to be a script by people who had sat down and said, OK, let's see what we can do with this. And in fact, for a while, David Cronenberg was interested in doing that script. So,
oh, really?
But Michael
Caine
Jones said a very funny thing, because they both opened on the same day and most of the press were saying, you know, how on earth can somebody who could make this film make that film? And he said, it is indication of my genius.
Peter, listening in New Hampshire. Simon, can you please say hi to John for me? In 1984, on the day before I emigrated, I met him in my local pub, The Grapes in Shepherd Market in London, W1, where he took the time to chat and enjoy a beverage with me. And I still proudly have my photograph that was taken at that time with him. He is a gentleman and a British treasure.
Thank you. Yeah, I remember it, actually. I do. I remember that time.
You remember 1984?
I remember that particular, yes, because I haven't been in The Grapes that many times, and I remember that happening, yeah.
Peter, you've impinged yourself into John Hurt's mind. Bill in Bedfordshire, will we see John in the last two Harry Potter films as Ollivander?
Yes, you will.
He's a man in charge of the wand store, because he disappeared.
He gets taken away and tortured and all sorts of things.
Well, of course, the provenance of the wands... The wand, plural, is incredibly important to the whole of the end of the Harry Potter.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it's central, in fact.
Was it fun?
Did you? You're probably not allowed to say anything about it.
You're never allowed to say anything about any of those big movies.
Do you have to sign things saying that you won't say anything?
We did with the Spielberg, definitely. Yes, woo, everything. I mean, it became almost ridiculous. You couldn't say, almost hardly say you were in it.
Weird Davey in Belfast. Simon, great to have John on the programme. One of my favourite John Hurt movies is Frankenstein Unbound. Could you ask John, does he have any standout memories from this film apart from kissing Bridget Fonda?
Well, I have a memory of that.
It's Corman, right? So.
I have to say, it isn't one of my fondest memories, that movie. It's
because?
Not one of my fondest memories. Well, I didn't think it worked at all as a film. And I think that Raoul Julia was of the same opinion. But some people, you never know, do you? Some people.
It's Davey's favourite.
Well, there you go.
There was a quote I saw from you, John, just a couple of years back in an interview that you gave. You said, I feel more electrified by life now than I ever did. Is that, I mean, I think what a fantastic thing to be able to say still, you know, still working after 120 movies and 34 years in the business. Is that how you feel in the beginning of 2010?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
What would you put that down to?
Working-wise? I don't know. I asked myself just that very same question recently. But I think, private life. Private life is always a great, hugely helpful. And my private life at the minute is hugely helpful.
Yes. Happily married?
Yes, very. Yeah.
Full-time lucky?
Yes, you could put it that way. Yes.
But to feel electrified about life, you know, I mean, that's fantastic position to be in when you've worked so hard.
I think
hard
it's also you work a few things out and you know that this is an endlessly fluctuating world. You've been through every argument as to its validity or whether it's valuable or whether it's worth it or whether it's not worth it. The thing is that you just reach a stage where you just say, well, take it for what it is. Take it for what moment, each moment. Take it existentially completely. And so I've sort of gone back to something that I started with. In a different way.
Can I ask the nerdy question? I'm sorry, because I mentioned this before. Because you narrated, Mandalay and Dover, so you worked with Lars von Trier. Did you work with... What's he like?
I love working with Lars. I did. I went over to Copenhagen both times to do...
Because he doesn't travel, does he? He stays
well,
where he is.
He doesn't travel, and I'm told that... That he can be tremendously tricky to work with on the floor.
I think tremendously tricky is an understatement for what other people have said about working with
him. But I don't know. We didn't have any of that at all. I mean, I found him very funny.
Yeah.
And very ironic. Yes, as much amused. And at the same time, we were finding our way to something which we thought was going to work. That's what it's about.
Did you see Antichrist? His new film.
No, I haven't seen that.
Because I think the thing with von Trier is it's funny because you say that he's very funny and Paul Bettany said exactly the same thing. And I think he is in the end. He's ironic and he's a prankster and he's not to be taken at face value. And yet Willem Dafoe came on the programme and said, well, during Antichrist, he was phenomenally depressed and we literally had to kind of nurse him out of the room onto the set. And I'm not sure how much of that to take seriously because it seems to me that he... Well, you see, even people, radio listeners can't see, but the face that you just pulled kind of implied that that might be right.
I'm not sure either. I don't know. I mean, I people kept telling me that he was manic depressive, but, that he was seriously, ill, and he was constantly worried about his illnesses and so on and so forth. But I didn't find that when I was working with him at all.
See, I think the whole thing's an act. I think he goes back...
Enough of your private theories. Oh, John's got to go. He has other business to attend to.
Thank you for clearing that up, John.
After 44-inch chess, what do we see you in, John? What else are you working on?
Oh, I don't know. After 44, would I work again? I don't know.
Here's what you're working on.
I don't know what I'm... Well, I hope very IMDb. Much. I hope that I will be able to get going the film with Richard Kwiatkowski called Regret Not Speaking, which I'm producing with my wife. I'm really the junior side of the production side. She's the experienced one. And hopefully we'll be able to get that going. It's a tricky time for independent films, but hopefully that's what we'll be doing next.
John, fantastic to have you on the programme. Really appreciate that. Thank you.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. John Hurt, you can see him in 44-inch chest, which we'll review properly later in the programme.
With yet another clip with all the swearing taken out of it, but this time without John
and
rolling his eyes.
And I can come again and I can answer those three questions all over again.
You can come on any time you like. Consider it an open invitation. And when that independent movie comes out, then you can come in and talk about it.
Oh, I'd love to do that.
John Hurt, thank you. So the email's mayo@bbc.co.uk. This one from Anne in Warwick. I don't know why the good doctor's so worried about the flappy hands thing you've been talking about. One, I laughed properly when I saw it in the thick of it. It is a comedy after all. And two, I've seen two films this week, Ghost Town and The Science of Sleep. Both films refer to large hands in the most complimentary of ways. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, say no more.
Well, hang on. I think, John, OK? Here's the thing. There was a thing...
No, John, he
can go to me. He's walking out the door. OK, fine. So there's a thing. Apparently, I have unusually large hands. Now, as somebody whose left hand... You said the thing that David Lynch appreciated about you was that you had a beautiful left hand. OK? You tell me. Yes, I can't do that.
Doing a bit of a Quentin Crisp thing there.
That's lovely. But do I... Right, put your hand up against mine. Yeah. Do you think I have unnaturally large hands?
Yes, clearly. You've got enormous hands.
I don't know about unnaturally. You're quite a big man, aren't you?
I am a big man, John, but I'm out of shape, in the words of Michael.
but I wouldn't have... It's a big hand, yes.
It's a big hand.
Is it unnaturally large? I mean, is this an ongoing argument?
Apparently it is,
an ongoing insult?
When he waves his hands, there's a big kind of like wind in the studio.
Oh, I see.
Anyway, John, those who are in charge of you are getting very sort of twitchy now.
Oh, are they?
You have to go and do other things.
Well, I don't want anyone to twitch.
No. So. John Hurt, thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'll see you again.
Thank you.
Now, who's this? This is an interesting one. Fred in Pennsylvania. Dear Fuzzy and Floppy, the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus came out over this weekend, the 9th and 10th of January, on just one screen here in the wilds of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, like a strange flower in a thicket of avatars. Terry Gilliam has delivered a film of wonderful, visceral, chewy corpulence. That's why I'm reading out this email. Because
that's very good. Wonderful,
visceral.
Hang on, you're going to write it down? No, yeah, I am, because I'm going to use that.
A film of wonderful, visceral, chewy corpulence with terrific performances, not only from Ledger and the Ledgerettes, which, stippled with humour and pathos, the film has a dwarf, music hall, London, Blackfriars, Bridge, Buddha, God and the Devil.
And Tom Waits.
Think Dickens, think Fellini, think Dali, think Gilliam. It's wonderful. So where is everybody? From Fred in Pennsylvania, no qualifications, just naturally intelligent, he says.
I think Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus did find an audience. I mean, I don't think it was...
In Pennsylvania, clearly.
Okay, fine.
This is from Sarah in Thamesmead. Yesterday, I found that I am going to be unexpectedly taking a flight home to Philadelphia on Saturday for the earlier than originally thought birth of my sister's first child. All very joyous, even if a tad chaotic at such short notice. The advice I need is in relation to the in-flight entertainment. Normally, with longer to plan, I would have stacked myself up with DVDs of my choice to watch on the flight. I simply don't have time to do that, so I went online and checked the selection of in-flight movies that the airline is offering on their seat-back entertainment. Imagine my joy when I saw that the films consist of Australia.
Well, I liked it.
Yes, all of it. Dragon Ball Evolution, Marley and Me, Max Payne, My Life in Ruins, The Time Traveller's Wife, and Bride Wars.
Okay.
As a loyal Wittertainment listener, these are all films I have gone to pains to avoid at the advice of the good doctor. Now I will be trapped on a 7-hour flight with just these as my entertainment choice. Could you please tell me which of these will hurt the least?
Yeah, absolutely. The Time Traveller's Wife. I didn't say to avoid Time Traveller's Wife. What I said was that it's the book is by, I always get this, it's Audrey Niffenegger, isn't it? That's how you,
it is.
Okay, fine. And the book is clearly unfilmable. And to some extent, what the film does is prove that the book is unfilmable. But it has a much better go at it than any of us had a right to expect. And for all the things that are sort of just don't quite gel about it, the things that are a little bit Doctor Who, Star Trek-y, you know, creaky in the wrong kind of way, there is enough in it that does work to make it a much better film than I thought it was going to be. The other thing was that it was one of those films that there was a sort of whiff about it before it turned up. I mean, I think we only saw it in the week of release. And I remember hearing, you know, reports, all troubled, you know, very difficult to do. I was rather surprised by the things that were right about it. Certainly of that selection that you've just read out, it is the standout movie.
Better than Australia?
Oh, no, but sorry. I thought we were discounting Australia because you said... obviously, fine. You've got 7 hours, right? Seven hours?
I believe that's right, yes.
OK. Australia is the best part of three. I think it's 2 hours 45, something like that. Australia, what, all of it? And it is, yes, all of it. I enjoyed Australia. Again, I know it didn't get very good reviews, although I liked it and Chris Tookie liked it. That was one of the moments in which me and Chris Tookie came together, like, you know, north and south. And
he being of the Daily Mail.
He being of the Daily Mail. And he and I have, in the past, have disagreed, I mean, particularly over the case of Crash, which I said was the best film of the year, and he said that it should be banned. Or he said, I think he didn't actually use the word banned, he said should be avoided with legal recourse. But we both agreed on that. So if you watch that, that's 2 hours 40. Then you take a 20-minute break to stretch your legs. Then you have to Time Traveller's Wife. That'll take you another 10 minutes. That's the best part of 5 hours accounted for.
That's probably enough. You don't want to watch anything else.
Well, you've got another 2 hours to kill. So what would the other...
Read a book.
Yeah, or
talk
you could...
Talk to the person next to you.
Yeah, you really want to do that on an aeroplane, don't you? Just read me the list quickly.
I don't want to go through the list again.
Quickly.
Marley and Me, Max Payne, My Life in Ruins, Bride Wars, Dragon Ball Evolution.
Max Payne of all of them, because it's completely head-baggingly stupid.
Sarah is concerned. She says her concern is that she wants to survive the flight without getting taken down by an air marshal for standing up on a flight and declaring the end of narrative cinema.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.